Well, folks, here we are, and I have on the phone with me Cameron Crowe, who's just rushed back into his home over in L.A. And welcome, Cameron. How are you?
Fine, you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Getting over a sudden surge of energy. I guess we'll start off right now. People have been hearing about you. We've been running a PSA about the fact that you're going to be here and talk with us tonight. What exactly do you consider yourself, first off, just to clarify things in my mind, an all-around journalist? Do you consider yourself an interviewer?
Sure. I guess at this point I kind of specialize in music, but that may change, you know, who knows?
But,
journalist.
Okay, journalist, so it's in all facts. You do reviews, do you do criticisms also?
Not much. In fact, very rarely these days do I feel like reviewing a record or something. It seems to have lost a lot of its importance over the last few years anyway, you know, record reviews.
Well, let's start. How does one become a rock and roll writer, for one thing, and then further than that, how does one make the context to do an interview with someone, let's say a David Bowie or a Neil Young?
Right. Well, actually, that won't happen for a while. That's something that you should work up to, and something that you kind of have to work up to, because people like you just mentioned don't really do that many interviews. And, I mean, they will go with someone that's been proven to be honest or reputable, you know. It's very rare that someone like Neil Young or David Bowie would do an interview with someone that showed up backstage at one of their concerts. The way to start would be to write for someone like your high school paper, which is what I did, and then move on from there, you know, submit your stuff to local magazines, local newspapers, and send those things to a bigger magazine, and you know, explain to them that you like to write for them, and then the connection with the bigger magazine gets you the better interviews.
What, looking back on it now?
Not necessarily the better interviews, but the bigger artists, the bigger names.
Definitely, looking back on it now, what would you consider to have been your first major break? Not necessarily the publications as they go up, but let's say the first person you met that gave you some dealing power.
It was probably Ben Fong-Torres, who's the senior editor of Rolling Stone. And I met him about 4 years ago at a Rolling Stones concert. And we got to talking, and he'd seen some of my stuff that was published in Cream magazine. And he decided to give me a chance to write about Poco for them, which I did. And again, that was a relationship with Richie Furay that I built up by writing about him for the San Diego Door when Poco had played in San Diego. San Diego Door being local underground.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed natural, and that article worked out. They gave me a shot at doing Yes, which was the next article I did, and the third piece was a cover on Greg Allman, which was probably my biggest break.
Yeah, I think that was, I had read a little of your writings in Cream, but I think that was one of the first major things of yours I read, the cover story there. How old were you at the time you met Ben Fong-Torres?
15.
15. And he trusted you to cover the Poco concert.
I don't think he knew how old I was at the time. And he did find out later, and it didn't seem to work against me.
That's.
But to him, I was a young journalist, you know, who could handle it.
Have you always been a writer?
Yeah, I guess so. I've always enjoyed writing, you know. I don't know if I was brought up with the idea of becoming a writer from day one, but I eased into it. It feels real comfortable. I enjoy it. You know, it's a nice craft. If I move on and do anything else, it'll always, you know, learning to express yourself on paper is something that can always come in handy.
In music, egos are, or in the entertainment business, egos are a large factor. When you're doing an interview, do you find that sometimes the people are just feeding you the lines they think they can use to create a stronger image for the public, or do you feel you get truth out?
Right.
What is happening at a point like that?
Well, see, you reach the point when, I reached the point where I realized to do an authentic portrait of an artist, or anyone for that matter, anyone that you're going to spend a lot of time writing about and analyzing for a lot of people, you should take the time out to learn about that person, you know, which means more than a hotel room interview for 45 minutes before a show. I've always tried, you know, in the past 3 years or so, to spend a lot of time around the subjects that I cover. So, to at least be fair to them as well as the reader, you know, interviews aren't the whole story. I think it's watching a person is much more important.
Let's get to the Bowie interview for a minute, since that's probably one of the most recent pieces of your work that people have seen since it appeared last month in Playboy.
Right.
I got the feeling that, well, how long did that interview take, first of all?
Truth?
The truth.
4 years.
I'm not sure if I can handle the truth then.
Well, what happened was, not 4 years, that's a bit of an exaggeration. And actually, that interview was all done in a span of about 2 years. And it's a compilation. And it's bits and pieces from 3 years worth of interviews with Bowie.
How is it possible?
A lot of cassette tapes there, Steve.
What happened
was I've been covering him for different magazines, Rolling Stone included. And I found myself, since he's you know, a verbose man, which doesn't mean that what everything he says is a lot of, you know, wind, but he does express himself in lengthy series of phrases. So I had a lot left over, is what I'm trying to say, from the articles that I'd done on him. And I put them together and submitted that to Playboy, who originally had told me to write an 800-word piece about the film The Man Who Fell to Earth. And they saw this. I sent it into them in a completed form with an introduction and everything. And I got a call from Barry Golson, you know, the guy that assisted on a Jimmy Carter interview. And he said he loved it, that he was going to run it exactly the way I'd sent it in, which is what he did.
And that's what we ended up reading.
Pardon me?
And that's what we ended up reading then.
Yes, and it's a surprise to me. I mean, it's a compliment that they didn't touch it. It was only 1 month away from that Jimmy Carter interview. Small place in history here.
Was that your most difficult interview? I mean, since it took so long, or I guess you couldn't really even consider that an interview. It's just a compilation of facts, almost.
Well, it's definitely an interview. Before I sent the piece in, I sat down with Bowie and went over the things that I was going to use and made sure that he actually felt that way still and didn't mind being tied to the thoughts that he expressed, say, 2 years ago. But most of it, I must tell you that the tone of that article was definitely set with a conversation that happened about a month before I sent it in. So it's very accurate, you know, and he has authorized its accuracy and everything. It's the best parts from a lot of interviews.
Okay, was that a difficult interview to bring off, or what was your most difficult?
No, it wasn't at all, because he's a great interview. You could conceivably ask him the lamest question in the world, and he would find something shocking to tell you as far as an answer.
Unlike the idea we get from the Beatles interviews when they first came over to America, or whatever went on for the next couple of years after that.
Doesn't seem to you that the Beatles, I've never really interviewed, the only Beatle I've ever met is George, you know, I've never interviewed any of them, but it seems like their interviews lack a lot of passion, you know?
I think it gets back to the image again, the image that either they felt was right for them or the management felt was right. One thing that's really important to me, personally, to ask you about, since music means so much to me, is how did your ideas on the music change from when you were in school or before you became a professional writer, or very close to the music and the people that run it, the actual money involved? How did your ideas change from on the music itself?
That's a good question, because I think about that a lot. I believe that I first started to realize that my opinion of music was going to change when I started getting promotional copies of albums in the mail from record companies. And those are, of course, sent, you know, free of charge. And I think I felt a small loss, because I used to buy all my albums and tapes and things. And I still do if something comes out and I don't want to wait the week that it's going to take for it to be sent to me or something. But you lose is that one thing. You know, if you buy an album, if you lay out $5 for an album, you're going to work to like it, you know. Whereas at this point, I tend to get a lot of albums in the mail, and you don't really have the time to, very rarely do you have the time to really get into something the way it probably should have gotten into. Which is one of the reasons I don't do record reviews, because, you know, usually when you do a record review, most of those reviews in Rolling Stone were done on a couple days of listening at the most to the album, and it's not realistic to someone that's going to buy the album and really work to get into it, you know?
Yeah, and that, well, it affects everybody another way, but what I was...
Well, I know what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah.
What you were asking was yeah.
Where is their art? I mean, where is their art and where does the business stop? I mean...
Well, I'll tell you, what occurs to... I just saw the Eagles last night, and I used to live in San Diego, so I was kind of around that whole scene when it was happening, because Glenn Frey was spending a lot of time in San Diego putting together that band. And so it was amazing to see the Eagles 4 years, or 5 years, however long it's been, since they first began, and here was a band that started out firmly dedicated to country rock. No glamour, no costumes, no frills, you know, just a straight thing. I saw them last night, and they had neon signs that were on for the extent of the show, and elaborate sets, and a totally, totally rehearsed and planned show. And it was very sad to me in a way. It was good, but it was sad. And it was like Don Kirshner presents the Eagles, almost. And in a way, that's where rock and roll is now. It's big business.
Do you think that's where they wanted to be, doing that? Or do you, they must know the changes they've gone through?
Well, listen, you have to think about it this way. They have a huge audience now, and that huge audience absolutely adored the show at the Forum. And so you have to think, you know, am I the one saying to Bob Dylan, hey, man, you've gone acoustic, I can't get it, or you've gone electric, I can't get into you anymore. You know, so I'm wondering if it's just me or if it's the public mandate that wants that, you know. It was still good, I enjoyed the show, but, you know, rock and roll has gotten into big business, very much.
No, hugely. You can think back to the changes in the last 10 years, and it's incredible.
Oh, yeah.
It really is, and the artists that are still around... If even listening to the albums and
sure, it's still music and rock and roll and pop music is very much in its heyday. You know, it's really, I feel a lot of the time it's a privilege to be around it. You know, documenting it, because it's like the golden age of theater almost at this point. Maybe people will look back in another 20 years and there'll be something else, maybe video discs or things like that. And, I mean, you'll remember fondly the days when Peter Frampton's album was number one for 17 weeks in a row, you know, the same way someone would think of how a Gable movie was, you know, huge when it first came out or something.
That's frightening in its own way, though, that thought.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But these people, you know, these people, the people that we all like, the people that we all listen to, are not kids, you know, they're not kids anymore. Peter Townsend is past 30, and he said he wanted to die before he got old 10 years ago, you know?
I think he may have hedged a little, made Daltrey sing the lines just in case. But, yeah, that...
It's true, though. Do you see any... Well, sure, there's a few. Springsteen probably is one of them. But there's just not that many young, strong artists coming up these days.
We were talking earlier today, we talked about some Hall & Oates, Poussette Dart Band. Who else, now that we're on the subject, who else do you see as coming up that someone might look for?
I think Nils Lofgren is going
to... Nils and I go back a long way. He lived down the street from me in Maryland. He was, well, we lived just outside Washington. No one thought he would ever make it. He's come a long way. And it's just the start for him.
He's definitely got the potential.
Yeah.
There's a few bands out there that are really good and that are trying their hard to break through on their own terms. Maybe they'll give up. Who knows?
Breaking through.
Back, and you have to consider them a new group with their lineup almost. So,
What have they gone through? About 20 personnel changes since the group first started.
People in the music business have been in Fleetwood Mac.
The theory just behind interviews, not even a theory, just an interview itself where one tries to convey the inner workings of someone that is very important to a mass of people, tries to bring that out, that's very important to me. And let's narrow it down a bit. We talked about this a little earlier too.
Yeah, we did.
There was a famous, I guess it came out in paperback book form, interview with Jerry Garcia called, it was by Charles Reich, and it was called the Garcia Interviews, I believe. And in that, they spent the afternoon extremely high, extremely stoned, looking at trees and whatever else, and Charles Reich kept right up joint for joint with Garcia to reach him.
My memory fails me now. Did they document that in the piece?
Do you mean did they let that be known?
Yes.
I read it in the Rolling Stone, and the little...
Strongly inferred, eh?
No, it came right out and said it.
Okay.
In the italics before the actual interview started.
I believe in honesty in reporting.
Well, do you find that's drugs and the interview, as drugs and music seem to go hand in hand? Do you find drugs and the interview happen?
Yeah, I also have to realize now, Stephen, that Garcia is one of those musicians that has always attached himself to the drug culture. And who knows what went through Charles Reich's mind, you know? Maybe he felt that was the only way to get to Garcia. Maybe he's like that all the time and just was himself around Jerry Garcia. Who knows? Are you asking...
Have you gone through an experience? Have you found...
...sometimes to make a good interview?
Sure. That's another way of putting it.
It absolutely depends on who you're interviewing. I hope that doesn't come off sounding like I'm backing off the subject. More musicians than you would ever think, and this is the total truth, are far more than you would think, are actually shrewd businessmen, you know, and they plot their careers out like it's on a blueprint. And quite a few of them seem to care enough, especially when I'm interviewing someone for Rolling Stone. They care enough about the way they're going to come off, and they're so conscious of how many people are going to be reading the interview, that they don't want to be too, you know, incapable of expressing themselves. There are many artists that get stoned and talk. I don't know. I personally cannot deal with an interview situation. You know, I was interviewing Hall & Oates the other day, you know, and this subject came up. Their publicist like was saying, "Does anyone want beers?" And I don't know, I forget what happened, but she asked Daryl Hall if he did interviews better when he was drunk. And he says, "No, I just have more fun," you know, which is true in his case, but I don't know what my point was really there. But sometimes you do need stuff to loosen up again. I mean, I personally can't do it, you know. I can't, I have to kind of be in control to be able to get what I need, you know, or get what's the essence of what's being said, you know.
Speaking of getting what you need, we were also talking this morning about a problem you had in Jamaica when you went over to interview Bob Marley. You might want to tell the
great
people.
I'll tell you what, you know, that Jamaica is a country that's all those people are stoned, you know, they smoke dope all day, and it's say if I was in Jamaica, you know, and this whole episode of me trying to, of you trying to get me on the phone and doing this interview and everything happened in Jamaica, I would have told you this morning, yes, I'll call you at 11:30, and then maybe 4 o'clock this morning I might have finally sauntered over to the phone and called you. And everything is so drawn out and so slow, there's no concept of time. So when Marley requested that I meet him in Kingston, Jamaica on a certain day, it was totally conceivable to him that I would understand when he called and said that he had a vision that he was going to win Rock Personality of the Year on the Rock Awards show, and he wanted to stay in New York where he was finishing up some business dealings. A Kirshner show was like a week from that day. I stayed in Jamaica and interviewed Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer, who were two of the original Wailers who are now not in that band, who never toured and never get over the States, and thus never do any interviews, you know, so it was fascinating to spend time around them. They have the attitude of Bob Marley is kind of a Paul McCartney-ish pop figure, whereas they feel are much heavier. Anyway, Marley never showed up. To make a long story,
incredible.
He had a vision the night before the Rock Awards were going to happen that, well, he wasn't going to win it, right? And he called me, he said, I'm coming back down to Jamaica, and by that point, I was on my way back to L.A. I'll get together with
him. It'll happen someday.
They have a phrase for it, and it's a phrase that everyone says from the hotel room service, you know, who explains to you the problem after you've, you know, 4 hours after you've ordered the meal, you know, right on down to Marley. They all say, soon come, man. Soon come.
Someday. Getting off interviews for just a second, I opened up the latest Led Zeppelin album, and smiling up at me were the below a paragraph of beautifully written words was the name Cameron Crowe, and it's the brand new Led Zeppelin album. They also shined up at me from Frampton Comes Alive. What is the deal to writing liner notes? Do you get asked, do you get approached by the band or the management, or?
Yes. On both of those occasions, I was, let me think about things. The Frampton thing happened in December of last year, or actually even earlier than that. Yes, on both times, it was, both accounts, it was the artist who requested the interviews, or requested the liner notes. In the case of Led Zeppelin, I got this cryptic phone call from Robert Plant one afternoon, you know, from England, saying, Jimmy Page and I are coming to L.A., and we want to have a meeting with you, you know, very ominous sounding, you know, we want to have a meeting with you, we'll call you next week, click, you know, type of thing. And they came to town and they called and I had a meeting with them and they told me what they were doing. They had this soundtrack album to the movie they were completing. And did I want to write liner notes? And I said, sure. A couple months later, some of their assistants and, you know, staff came out with a print of the film and showed it to the person that was going to do the designing on the album and me and a few other people around, you know, friends of the band and everything. And I took notes and went back and wrote that and turned down on the album.
Something like that should be taken as a great compliment that they came to you, right?
Yeah, I was very flattered. Led Zeppelin's been around a long time and they no doubt spent a lot of time with the journalists over the years, and for them to ask me to do that was really nice. There's one thing I want to say, though. Towards the end of those liner notes, I think in the last paragraph, there is a strongly English-sounding phrase there. Let me get the album up here. I think it's by where I am here. What happened was that Jimmy put in like one sentence in the middle, or one phrase in the middle of one of the sentences, because he didn't want to offend the British Led Zeppelin fans with something that sounded too American. So he changed, let me see, he changed, you know, like wild to whilst and stuff. And proof that amidst it all, while living the reflections of their music.
That was not Cameron Crowe.
That's the one part that isn't mine. While living the reflections of their music. I don't know what that means.
I thought that was a great line, too.
Well, on second thought, I did write that.
It all comes out.
It had nothing to do. I don't particularly understand it.
Our
it's
people...
Nice, I mean, I'm glad they turned out the way they did.
Are people that make their lives around the music, from roadies to the writers to the people in radio, I have a premise that I go on. I have a premise that they're either frustrated stars and they're trying to gain something by being close to the source of their frustration, or they're either groupies in a way, and... you disagreed with me on that. Do you want to say why?
I have strong feelings about that word groupie. You know?
I used the wrong word. I probably could have used a different word, but since I did use that word, go ahead.
Well, it is very true. You know, you made a really good observation, and that is that a lot of people, you know, roadies and so forth, and even a lot of people that review records.
Yeah, Cameron, if I could just interrupt a second, could you speak up just a little bit more of the dials? A little low.
Okay. basically what I was saying was that you were right. There are a lot of people that are close to the music that's going down who are in themselves frustrated musicians, you know. And this is the level of power that they could rise to doing something else, but being close to that music that they'd love to be making. I don't play any instruments. I have no ambitions to be a musician, you know, so I don't, in a way it's kind of a rarity. It is true that most of the people that review records are musicians, you know, which is good maybe, you know, as long as they aren't frustrated, because then they know what they're talking about. As far as the word groupie, I was never a groupie, you know. I have connotations of groupie being a word that describes someone that hangs out around a band or some level of power in the music business.
But
it could be anything.
As we were talking earlier, you have spent a long amount of time. In fact, you have been on the road with bands.
Yes.
But that was simply as part of your work, right?
That's serving a purpose, you know. I feel strongly about that because too often there are people that don't serve a purpose that tend to dilute a situation that could be really nice in terms of an interview or anything else. You know, someone entering a room, say, where an interview was going on, if I was doing an interview with, I don't know, Neil Young, and some girl walked in, you know, wow, man, you're Neil Young, you know, can I sit here and listen, you know? And then this happens every now and then, and Neil isn't the type of guy that's going to say, no, get lost. And he would say, sure, you know, but he would alter, you know, he would feel that he would have to be something for this girl or something like that. And so I get real defensive over the word groupie being applied to what I do. It's just not true, you know, I'm a journalist, I've been on the road with Jack Ford, you know, and that kind of situation too, so it's not like I thirst for this rock and roll energy. If anything, I find myself drifting away from it, you know, more and more. I like to just do my work and kind of get out.
Yeah, that was interesting. I was going to ask you if you weren't a groupie, but you just answered it, not a groupie, but why if you didn't feel that frustration, were you solely into doing music writing, and that's groupie, not the case.
Groupie can be, you know, can mean anything from someone who's hanging out to try and, you know, hit on a rock star to you.
Yes, it certainly could.
Being a huge music fan, working out of the radio station that you work out of, and being close to the music, you know, following it very closely, knowing who I am, you know.
Well, we are spreading that knowledge rapidly, I have the feeling. Is everybody...
I prefer journalist, you know.
Journalist, that's it's a tame term, you know, in a wild scene, I imagine. But it's something to hold on to. What's your favorite music, personally?
My favorite music is good music. I always used to, in the very beginning, I would do interviews and I would ask artists, what kind of stuff do they listen to? And they would always say, good music, or all kinds of music, as long as it's, you know, decent. And I would always get so frustrated over that answer, but it's true. You know, the more music you listen to, the more music you appreciate. I like everything from classical to country. You know, bits of each one. So.
As long as it's done well.
In the end, it's usually the Joni Mitchell or the Jackson Browne or the Neil Young or the Led Zeppelin, you know, that eventually finds itself onto the turntable.
Are there any major projects coming up for you?
Well, possibly a biography on Neil Young. That's definitely going to happen one day, you know, something that he's authorized.
That's something very special, too, because Neil Young does very few interviews, very few statements to the public, as far as that I've been able to ever find.
See, he also asked me to do that book, which is probably, you know, if I had to pick one compliment that's meant the most to me, it was that. And he asked me to do this book and told me he had a lot of drawings and things and that he wanted to add to it. He knows that people want to know about him, and he's almost ready to do a biography. He's reached the point in his career where he's done enough, and that it's time to document it. So that may come up soon. That may come up in a while. You know, Neil Young operates on Neil Young time, and that's roughly equivalent to Jamaican time.
He seems to be a person that's not gotten the hard shell around them from the music business. It seems that a lot of people just get eaten up by it, and they become almost walking machines for their careers, or just to fight off all the really strong influences that surround them. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what Neil Young is like and what you find the changes in the musicians themselves are, just to keep up the pace, which must be really frantic, even for someone like you, a writer.
First of all, there's one thing that people tend to forget, and I have forgotten it, and someone brought it up to me in an interview a couple of years ago, and I have not forgotten it since, and it's very true. The bigger you get, the more successful that you get, the harder it is for you to make your music, which is very true. You think about an artist like Jackson Browne, who had 23 years to do his first album and then 7 months to do his next one, you know. Plus, the bigger you get, the more demands there are on your time to tour and everything. So it's very hard, and you learn to respect the people that keep it together. And Neil Young is definitely one of those people. He's very, very, very unaffected by it all. Very unpretentious, nice guy, and an intense, intense artist. He won't do anything that'll dilute his music at all. He won't play an acoustic song if the audience is yelling. I can't complete this phrase on the radio, but on the Stills and Young tour, Neil was going into a new song that he'd written. I believe it was a song he'd written called Requiem for a President that he'd written the night before about Pat Nixon, who had just had a stroke. He writes that way, you know. He writes 3 songs a week easily, you know, 2 in a day sometimes.
Ohio came out pretty quick.
Yes, very quickly. Yeah, the only really political song that Neil's done. Well, there are a few others. Anyway, Neil's going into this song. It's a gentle acoustic song, and audience just started yelling. It was at a stadium. He very calmly put down his guitar and left. You know, the audience didn't know what to do. And he eventually came back out. Stills had to cover for him for a long time. But he basically feels that big crowds are... And this is what he came back out and said and explained why he did that. And he said, basically, in my heart, he said, I feel that playing these big places in these stadiums is a lot of BS, you know. And it took a lot of courage for him to say that and everything. But that's the way he feels. And on this tour he's doing with Crazy Horse now, he's not playing the big places generally. He has to play the Forum in L.A., but he's also playing a date a couple of days before at a very small place in town that he hasn't even announced, and he's going to let people just find out about it and be there to see him.
Yeah, I think the Grateful Dead just tried something similar to that on a tour back east.
Yeah.
Where
It works. It, for someone that's that interested in their music, it works very definitely. Neil spends a lot of time thinking, you know, to make sure he's doing the right thing. He doesn't let himself get caught up in snap decisions.
Are you happy doing what you're doing and meeting the people you meet and keeping up the pace you have to keep up?
God, I can't think of a less cliche way to say it, but I'm just as happy as I can be doing what I'm doing. It's really a thrill, you know. It's a thrill that people read my stuff, you know. It's a thrill that people, you know, put stock in an observation I might make about someone. And if I think about it too much, it might throw me off a little bit. But every now and again, it does cross my mind, and it feels real good, and not necessarily, well, a little bit in an ego way, but basically, it's just a real flattering thing. And I'm very happy, and whatever I do, it'll be a real fond memory, you know?
And at this point in your career, we just talked about the Neil Young book being one of the most flattering things that's happened to you. What are you most proud of at this point?
There was another thing that happened as far as writing, you know, what am I most proud of as far as a piece I've
done? As far as anything that has affected your career, anything that you've put out.
Yeah. There was one thing that happened. I was hired by the New York Times Magazine section to write a piece about Bob Dylan and what he meant to me in the you know, being someone that wasn't around when the Times They Are Changing first came out and blew everyone's mind, you know. So they were curious what someone who was under 21 had to think about, had to say about Bob Dylan, you know. And I tried to get an interview with Dylan. I know his publicist from working with that man over other artists. And I mentioned to him that I had this assignment, and would he mention to Bob that I would like to do an interview, but I would understand if he didn't want to do one. And the message came back to me from Dylan. What he did is he asked me to write it out, you know, what I wanted to talk to him about. And so I did. And he sent back a reply through his publicist that was very complimentary, you know, and said that he had read my stuff and that he knew who I was and, you know, liked the things I had to write. But at this point in his career, he would rather, since the assignment of the piece was what I had to think about Bob Dylan, he would rather not dilute that by talking to me. You know, which was a great compliment. I took it that way. I had no choice. I could either bum out or not getting the interview. But no, that was flattering. As far as pieces that I've written, I'm really proud of the Jackson Browne cover that I did a couple of years ago for Rolling Stone. I'm proud of the Neil Young interview, obviously. I'm proud of the Jack Ford piece that I did. I'm proud of the Stills and Young piece that I did. There are quite a few things.
You know,
I went over and made a list the other day of the articles that I've done, and it was many more than I had realized, and that was a nice feeling. A lot of them I was real proud of.
Prolific man.
It doesn't seem that way to me, I'll tell you.
It seems in a lot of magazines I've read it, and it's not just one. You work primarily for Rolling Stone, but you can be printed in any magazine.
Right.
That's true.
That's my reason.
Do you find there's a lot of backstabbing that goes on in the business itself?
Backstabbing goes on in any business, you know, any business at all. If there was someone that wanted to take your place, there's a good chance that he would give backstabbing a shot. I mean, if he wanted your place badly enough, you know, it happens, sure. You just gotta try and be as honorable as you can and be able to stand up at any to any criticism that might come your way. You know, that's the only way you can do. If you think too much about all the people that might like to take your place or all the people that might, you know, like to make it hard for you because it was hard for them, you can get very hung up in thinking like that.
Cameron, I'm about all talked out, and I'm coming near the end of the show, too. And
play that music, white boy.
Number one in the country, I believe it went to. Number 18 on our charts,
Wild
Cherry.
Boy, I saw that guy on Midnight Special last night. He looked like a pockmarked, Mark Stidrich or something.
Is the performer white or black?
He's white.
Is
very
he?
Very white.
So it's tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, he has a black horn section that in the chorus of that song, when they go, play that song, they point to him.
I guess, you know, it's another way to make a buck.
Really?
But, anyway, I was going to thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you.
And,
I'm surprised. Didn't you have to break in with a PSA or a time call or something like that?
On college radio, we're lucky that we can get around that to a point. It is non-commercial. And we are. To a point. I really believe that college radio is one of the last places where you can get a creative radio show, where you can combine classical music with rock and roll, with jazz, all in the same set, which is what I try to do on my own show. But that's a whole other story, and I don't got another hour and a half. In fact, I got 11 minutes before I turn off. But there's one...
Do you feel like I do, you know? Take you right past that time.
That's quite all right. No, really.
Listen, thank you. You know, I appreciate the opportunity to do an interview for UCR and all that business because I used to live right next to UCR and walk around the campus a lot and everything. So it's nice. You know?
Well, you must have been bored.
Yeah,
had nothing else to do.
No, as a matter of fact, I saw the Beach Boys there once.
Oh, was this
great show.
The benefit they did here, I guess, about 4 years ago?
Yes, I think so.
I was at the same show. Were you
that
sat in front of me and wouldn't get down? No, but I'm going to ask you not to hang up. I'm going to take you off the air in just a second, and I have an old friend of yours here.
Okay.
who might want to talk to you.
All right.
But I have one thing. I felt I might be important to let the people know that you were probably in one of the true romances, the great romances in history. There's been Romeo and Juliet and the prince that stepped down out of the royalty to marry the woman he loved, the American. There's been those famous love stories, but I don't feel many have reached the heights of the love affair you had with Barbie Benton. And I just want to know that my feeling with all my heart goes out to you for that.
Barbie's a great gal.
I bet she is.
I promised her I wouldn't talk about her in any interviews, but she's, Jeff doesn't really know about us yet.
Okay, well, we better just call this.
Does KFXM still operate?
Yeah, they're, as a matter of fact, the number one FAM station in this area.
Did they change their format?
No, they're still lagging behind, trying to catch up, keep up with KFXM. Cameron, everything changes and nothing changes.
Really? Take me off the air.
Okay, I'm going to take you off the air, and here is an old friend.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Folks, I just finished the old interview, and we're going to get back into some music with all the technical things going on here. It's a little confusing, but here we go.